After lunch was a peaceful time at Sanssouci. Mr. Cayley went to have his rest with the devoted Mrs. Cayley in attendance. Mrs. Blenkinsop was conducted by Miss Minton to a depot to pack and address parcels for the front. Mr. Meadows strolled gently out into Leehampton and along the front. He bought a few cigarettes, stopped at Smith's to purchase the latest number of Punch, then, after a few minutes of apparent irresolution, he entered a bus bearing the legend Old Pier. The Old Pier was at the extreme end of the promenade. That part of Leehampton was known to house agents as the least desirable end. It was West Leehampton, and poorly thought of. Tommy paid tuppence, and strolled up the pier. It was a flimsy and weather-worn affair, with a few moribund penny-in-the-slot machines placed at far distant intervals. There was no one on it but some children running up and down and screaming in voices that matched quite accurately the screaming of the gulls, and one solitary man sitting on the end fishing. Mr. Meadows strolled up to the end and gazed down into the water. Then he asked gently, "Caught anything?" The fisherman shook his head. "Don't often get a bite." Mr. Grant reeled in his line a bit. He said without turning his head, "What about you, Meadows?" Tommy said, "Nothing much to report as yet, sir. I'm digging myself in." "Good. Tell me." Tommy sat on an adjacent bollard, so placed that he commanded the length of the pier. Then he began, "I've gone down quite all right, I think. I gather you've already got a list of the people there." Grant nodded. "There's nothing to report as yet. I've struck up a friendship with Major Bletchley. We played golf this morning. He seems the ordinary type of retired officer. If anything, a shade too typical. Cayley seems a genuine hypochondriacal invalid. Well, that again would be an easy part to act. He has, by his own admission, been a good deal in Germany during the last few years."
"A point," said Grant laconically.
"Then there's von Deinem."
"Yes, I don't need to tell you, Meadows, that von Deinem is the one I'm most interested in."
"You think he's N?"
Grant shook his head.
"No, I don't. As I see it, N couldn't afford to be a German. Not a refugee from Nazi persecution, even?"
"Not even that. We watch, and they know we watch all the enemy aliens in this country. Moreover, this is in confidence, Beresford, very nearly all enemy aliens between 16 and 60 will be interned. Whether our adversaries are aware of that fact or not, they can at any rate anticipate that such a thing might happen. They would never risk the head of their organization being interned. N, therefore, must be either a neutral, or else he is, apparently, an Englishman. The same, of course, applies to M. No, my meaning about von Deinem is this. He may be a link in the chain. N or M may not be at Sanssouci. It may be Carl von Deinem who is there, and through him we may be led to our objective. That does seem to me highly possible. The more so as I cannot very well see that any of the other inmates of Sanssouci are likely to be the person we're seeking."
"You've had them more or less vetted, I suppose, sir?"
Grant sighed, a sharp, quick sigh of vexation. "No, that's just what it's impossible for me to do. I could have them looked up by the department easily enough, but I can't risk it, Beresford. For you see, the rot is in the department itself. One hint that I've got my eye on Sanssouci for any reason, and the organization may be put wise. That's where you come in, the outsider. That's why you've got to work in the dark without help from us. It's our only chance, and I daren't risk alarming them. There's only one person I've been able to check up on."
"Who's that, sir?"
"Carl von Deinem himself."
"That's easy enough.
Routine. I can have him looked up, not from the Sanssouci angle, but from the enemy alien angle."
Tommy asked curiously, "And the result?"
A curious smile came over the other's face. "Master Carl is exactly what he says he is. His father was indiscreet, was arrested and died in a concentration camp. Carl's elder brothers are in camps. His mother died in great distress of mind a year ago. He escaped to England a month before war broke out. Von Deinem has professed himself anxious to help this country. His work in a chemical research laboratory has been excellent and most helpful on the problem of immunizing certain gases and in general decontamination experiments."
Tommy said,
Well, then he's all right. But not necessarily. Our German friends are notorious for their thoroughness. If von Deinem was sent as an agent to England, special care would be taken that his record should be consistent with his own account of himself. There are two possibilities. The whole von Deinem family may be parties to the arrangement, not improbable under the painstaking Nazi regime, or else, this is not really Karl von Deinem, but a man playing the part of Karl von Deinem. Tommy said slowly, I see. He added inconsequently, He seems an awfully nice young fellow. Sighing, Grant said, They are. They nearly always are. It's an odd life, this service of ours. We respect our adversaries, and they respect us. You usually like your opposite number, you know, even when you're doing your best to down him. There was silence as Tommy thought over the strange anomaly of war. Grant's voice broke into his musings. But there are those for whom we've neither respect nor liking. And those are the traitors within our own ranks, the men who are willing to betray their country and accept office and promotion from the foreigner who has conquered it. Tommy said with feeling, My God, I'm with you, sir. That's a skunk's trick. And deserves a skunk's end. Tommy said incredulously, And there really are these swine? Everywhere, as I told you. In our service, in the fighting forces, on parliamentary benches, high up in the ministries. We've got to comb them out. We've got to. And we must do it quickly. It can't be done from the bottom, the small fry, the people who speak in the parks, who sell their wretched little news sheets. They don't know who the big bugs are. It's the big bugs we want. They're the people who can do untold damage, and will do it unless we're in time. Tommy said confidently, We shall be in time, sir. Grant asked, What makes you say that? Tommy said, Well, you've just said it. We've got to be. The man with the fishing line turned and looked full at his subordinate for a minute or two, taking in anew the quiet, resolute line of the jaw. He had a new liking and appreciation of what he saw. He said quietly, Good man. He went on, What about the women in this place? Anything strike you as suspicious there? I think there's something odd about the woman who runs it. Mrs. Perenna? Yes, you don't know anything about her, Grant said slowly. I might see what I could do about checking her antecedents, but as I told you, it's risky. Yes, better not take any chances. She's the only one who strikes me as suspicious in any way. There's a young mother, a fussy spinster, the hypochondriac's brainless wife, and a rather fearsome-looking old Irish woman. All seem harmless enough on the face of it. That's the lot, is it? No, there's a Mrs. Blenkinsop. Arrived 3 days ago. Well? Tommy said, Mrs. Blenkinsop is my wife. What? In the surprise of the announcement, Grant's voice was raised. He spun round, sharp anger in his gaze. I thought I told you, Beresford, not to breathe a word to your wife. Quite right, sir, and I didn't. If you'll just listen. Succinctly, Tommy narrated what had occurred. He did not dare look at the other. He carefully kept out of his voice the pride that he secretly felt. There was a silence when he brought the story to an end. Then a queer noise escaped from the other. Grant was laughing. He laughed for some minutes. He said, I take my hat off to the woman. She's one in a thousand. I agree, said Tommy. East Hampton will laugh when I tell him this. He warned me not to leave her out. Said she'd get the better of me if I did. I wouldn't listen to him. It shows you, though, how damn careful you've got to be. I thought I'd taken every precaution against being overheard. I'd satisfied myself beforehand that you and your wife were alone in the flat. I actually heard the voice on the telephone asking your wife to come round at once, and so I was tricked by the old simple device of the bang door. Yes, she's a smart woman, your wife. He was silent for a moment. Then he said, Tell her from me, will you, that I eat dirt. And I suppose now she's in on this? Mr. Grant made an expressive grimace. Well, she's in on it, whether we like it or not. Tell her the department would esteem it an honour if she will condescend to work with us over the matter. I'll tell her, said Tommy with a faint grin. Grant said seriously, You couldn't persuade her, I suppose, to go home and stay home. Tommy shook his head. You don't know Tuppence. I think I'm beginning to. I said that because, well, it's a dangerous business. If they get wise to you, or to her... He left the sentence unfinished. Tommy said gravely, I do understand that, sir. But I suppose even you couldn't persuade your wife to keep out of danger, Tommy said slowly. I don't know that I would really want to do that. Tuppence and I, you see, aren't on those terms. We go into things together. In his mind was that phrase, uttered years ago at the close of an earlier war, a joint venture. That was what his life with Tuppence had been, and would always be, a joint venture. Chapter 4 When Tuppence entered the lounge at Sanssouci just before dinner, the only occupant of the room was the monumental Mrs. O'Rourke, who was sitting by the window looking like some gigantic Buddha. She greeted Tuppence with a lot of geniality and verve. Ah, now, if it isn't Mrs. Blenkinsop! You're like myself. It pleases you to be down to time and to get a quiet minute or two before going into the dining room. And a pleasant room this is in good weather, with the windows open in the way that you'll not be noticing the smell of cooking. Terrible, that is, in all these places, and more especially if it's onion and cabbage that's on the fire. Sit here now, Mrs. Blenkinsop, and tell me what you've been doing with yourself this fine day and how you like Lee Hampton. There was something about Mrs. O'Rourke that had an unholy fascination for Tuppence. She was rather like an ogress dimly remembered from early fairy tales, with her bulk, her deep voice, her unabashed beard and moustache, her deep, twinkling eyes, and the impression she gave of being more than life-size. She was indeed not unlike some childhood's fantasy. Tuppence replied that she thought she was going to like Lee Hampton very much, and be happy there. That is, she added in a melancholy voice, as happy as I can be anywhere with this terrible anxiety weighing on me all the time. Ah, now, don't you be worrying yourself, Mrs. O'Rourke advised comfortably. Those boys of yours will come back to you safe and sound, not a doubt of it. One of them's in the Air Force, I think you said. Yes, Raymond. And he's in France now, or in England? He's in Egypt at the moment, but from what he said in his last letter, well, not exactly said, but we have a little private code, if you know what I mean. Certain sentences mean certain things. I think that's quite justified, don't you? Mrs. O'Rourke replied promptly. Indeed I do. 'Tis a mother's privilege. Yes, you see, I feel I must know just where he is. Mrs. O'Rourke nodded the Buddha-like head. I feel for you entirely, so I do. If I had a boy out there, I'd be deceiving the censor in the very same way, so I would. And your other boy, the one in the Navy? Tuppence entered obligingly upon a saga of Douglas. You see, she cried, I feel so lost without my three boys. They've never been all away together from me before. They're all so sweet to me. I really do think they treat me more as a friend than a mother. She laughed self-consciously. I have to scold them sometimes, and make them go out without me. What a pestilential woman I sound, thought Tuppence to herself. She went on aloud, and I really didn't know quite what to do or where to go. The lease of my house in London was up, and it seemed so foolish to renew it, and I thought if I came somewhere quiet and yet with a good train service... She broke off. Again the Buddha nodded. I agree with you entirely. London is no place at the present. Ah, the gloom of it! I've lived there myself for many a year now. I'm by way of being an antique dealer, you know. You may know my shop in Cornaby Street, Chelsea. Kate Kelly's the name over the door. Lovely stuff I had there, too. Oh, lovely stuff. Mostly glass, Waterford, Cork, beautiful. Chandeliers, and lustres, and punch bowls, and all the rest of it. Foreign glass, too, and small furniture, nothing large, just small period pieces, mostly walnut and oak. Oh, lovely stuff, and I had some good customers. But there, when there's a war on, all that goes west. I'm lucky to be out of it with as little loss as I've had. A faint memory flickered through Tuppence's mind. A shop filled with glass, through which it was difficult to move. A rich, persuasive voice, a compelling, massive woman. Yes, surely she had been into that shop. Mrs. O'Rourke went on. I'm not one of those that like to be always complaining, not like some that's in this house. Mr. Cayley, for one, with his muffler and his shawls and his moans about his business going to pieces. Of course it's to pieces. There's a war on. And his wife, with never boo to say to a goose. Then there's that little Mrs. Sprott, always fussing about her husband. Is he out at the front?
Not he. He's a tuppenny-halfpenny clerk in an insurance office, that's all, and so terrified of air raids that he's had his wife down here since the beginning of the war. Mind you, I think that's right where the child's concerned, and a nice wee mite she is. But Mrs. Sprott, she frets. For all that her husband comes down when he can, keeps saying Arthur must miss her so. But if you ask me, Arthur's not missing her over much. Maybe he's got other fish to fry.
Tuppence murmured. I'm terribly sorry for all these mothers. If you let your children go away without you, you never stop worrying. And if you go with them, it's hard on the husbands being left.
Ah, yes, and it comes expensive running two establishments.
But this place seems quite reasonable, said Tuppence.
Yes, I'd say you get your money's worth. Mrs. Perrin is a good manager.
There's a queer woman for you now.
In what way? Asked Tuppence.
Mrs. O'Rourke said with a twinkle,
You'll be thinking I'm a terrible talker. It's true, I'm interested in all my fellow creatures. That's why I sit in this chair as often as I can. You see who goes in and who goes out and who's on the veranda and what goes on in the garden. And what were we talking of now? Oh, yes, Mrs. Perrenna and the queerness of her. There's been a grand drama in that woman's life, or I'm much mistaken.
Do you really think so?
I do now. And the mystery she makes of herself. And where might you come from in Ireland? I asked her. And would you believe it? She held out on me, declaring she was not from Ireland at all.
You think she is Irish?
Of course she's Irish. I know my own countrywomen, and I could name you the county she comes from. But there. I'm English, she says, and my husband was a Spaniard.
Mrs. O'Rourke broke off abruptly as Mrs. Sprott came in, closely followed by Tommy. Tuppence immediately assumed a sprightly manner.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Meadows. You look very brisk this evening.
Tommy said, Oh, plenty of exercise, that's the secret. A round of golf this morning and a walk along the front this afternoon. Millicent Sprott said,
I took baby down to the beach this afternoon. She wanted to paddle, but I really thought it was rather cold. I was helping her build a castle, and a dog ran off with my knitting and pulled out yards of it. So annoying, and so difficult picking up all the stitches again. I'm such a bad knitter.
You're getting along fine with that helmet, Mrs. Blenkinsop, said Mrs. O'Rourke suddenly, turning her attention to Tuppence. You've been just racing along. I thought Miss Minton said that you were an inexperienced knitter.
Tuppence flushed faintly. Mrs. O'Rourke's eyes were sharp. With a slightly vexed air, Tuppence said,
I've really done quite a lot of knitting. I told Miss Minton so, but I think she likes teaching people.
Everybody laughed in agreement, and a few minutes later the rest of the party came in and the gong was sounded. The conversation during the meal turned on the absorbing subject of spies. Well-known hoary chestnuts were retold. The nun with the muscular arm, the clergyman descending from his parachute and using unclergyman-like language as he landed with a bump. The Austrian cook who secreted a wireless in her bedroom chimney, and all the things that had happened, or nearly happened, to aunts and second cousins of those present. That led easily to fifth column activities, to denunciations of the British fascists, of the communists, of the peace party, of conscientious objectors. It was a very normal conversation of the kind that may be heard almost every day. Nevertheless, Tuppence watched keenly the faces and demeanour of the people as they talked, striving to catch some telltale expression or word. But there was nothing. Sheila Perrenna alone took no part in the conversation, but that might be put down to her habitual taciturnity. She sat there, her dark, rebellious face sullen and brooding. Karl von Deinem was out tonight, so tongues could be quite unrestrained. Sheila only spoke once towards the end of dinner. Mrs. Sprott had just said,
Where I do think the Germans made such a mistake in the last war was to shoot Nurse Cavill. It turned everybody against them.
It was then that Sheila, flinging back her head, demanded in her fierce young voice,
Why shouldn't they shoot her? She was a spy, wasn't she?
Oh, no, not a spy.
She helped English people to escape in an enemy country. That's the same thing. Why shouldn't she be shot?
Oh, but shooting a woman and a nurse.
Sheila got up.
I think the Germans were quite right, she said.
She went out of the window into the garden. Dessert, consisting of some underripe bananas and some tired oranges, had been on the table some time. Everyone rose and adjourned to the lounge for coffee. Only Tommy unobtrusively betook himself to the garden.
He found Sheila Perenna leaning over the terrace wall, staring out to the sea. He came and stood beside her. By her hurried, quick breathing, he knew that something had upset her badly. He offered her a cigarette, which she accepted. He said, "Lovely night." In a low, intense voice, the girl answered, "It could be." Tommy looked at her doubtfully. He felt suddenly the attraction and the vitality of this girl. There was a tumultuous life in her, a kind of compelling power. She was the kind of girl, he thought, that a man might easily lose his head over. "If it weren't for the war, you mean?" he said. "I didn't mean that at all. I hate the war." "So do we all." "Not in the way I mean. I hate the cant about it, the smugness, the horrible, horrible patriotism."
"Patriotism?"
Tommy was startled. "Yes. I hate patriotism. Do you understand? All this country, 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 betraying your country, dying for your country, serving your country. Why should one's country mean anything at all?"
Tommy said simply, "I don't know. It just does."
"Not to me."
"Oh, it would to you. You go abroad and buy and sell in the British Empire and come back bronzed and full of clichés, talking about the natives and calling for chotepegs and all that sort of thing."
Tommy said gently, "I'm not quite as bad as that, I hope, my dear. I'm exaggerating a little, but you know what I mean. You believe in the British Empire and the stupidity of dying for one's country."
"My country," said Tommy dryly, "doesn't seem particularly anxious to allow me to die for it."
"Yes, but you want to, and that's so stupid. Nothing's worth dying for. It's all an idea, talk, talk, froth, high-flown idiocy. My country doesn't mean anything to me at all."
"Some day," said Tommy, "you'll be surprised to find that it does."
"No, never. I've suffered, I've seen—"
She broke off, then turned suddenly and impetuously upon him.
"Do you know who my father was?"
"No." Tommy's interest quickened.
"His name was Patrick Maguire. He was a follower of Casement in the last war. He was shot as a traitor, all for nothing, for an idea. He worked himself up with those other Irishmen. Why couldn't he just stay at home quietly and mind his own business? He's a martyr to some people and a traitor to others. I think he was just stupid."
Tommy could hear the note of pent-up rebellion coming out into the open. He said, "So, that's the shadow you've grown up with."
"Shadow's right. Mother changed her name. We lived in Spain for some years. She always says that my father was half a Spaniard. We always tell lies wherever we go. We've been all over the continent. Finally, we came here and started this place. I think this is quite the most hateful thing we've done yet."
Tommy asked, "How does your mother feel about things?"
"Well, you mean about my father's death?"
Sheila was silent a moment, frowning, puzzled. She said slowly,
"I've never really known. She never talks about it. It's not easy to know what mother feels or thinks."
Tommy nodded his head thoughtfully.
Sheila said abruptly, "I don't know why I've been telling you this. I got worked up. Where did it all start?"
"A discussion on Edith Cavell."
"Oh, yes. Patriotism. I said I hated it."
"Aren't you forgetting Nurse Cavell's own words?"
"What words?"
"Before she died, don't you know what she said?"
He repeated the words.
"Patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred in my heart."
"Oh."
She stood there, stricken for a moment. Then, turning quickly, she wheeled away into the shadow of the garden.
"So you see, Tuppence, it would all fit in."
Tuppence nodded thoughtfully. The beach around them was empty. She herself leaned against a breakwater. Tommy sat above her, and the breakwater itself, from which post he could see anyone who approached along the esplanade. Not that he expected to see anyone, having ascertained with a fair amount of accuracy where people would be this morning. In any case, his rendezvous with Tuppence had borne all the signs of a casual meeting, pleasurable to the lady and slightly alarming to himself. Tuppence said,
"Mrs. Perenna?"
"Yes. M, not N. She satisfies the requirements."
Tuppence nodded thoughtfully again.
Yes. She's Irish, as spotted by Mrs. O'Rourke.
Won't admit the fact. Has done a good deal of coming and going on the continent. Changed her name to Perenna, came here and started this boarding house. Splendid bit of camouflage. Full of innocuous bores. Her husband was shot as a traitor. She's got every incentive for running a fifth column show in this country.
Yes, it fits.
Is the girl in it too, do you think?
Tommy said finally, definitely not. She'd never have told me all this otherwise.
I feel a bit of a cad, you know.
Tuppence nodded with complete understanding.
Yes, one does. In a way, it's a foul job, this.
But very necessary.
Oh, of course.
Tommy said, flushing slightly, I don't like lying any better than you do.
Tuppence interrupted him.
Oh, I don't mind lying in the least. To be quite honest, I get a lot of artistic pleasure out of my lies. What gets me down is those moments when one forgets to lie, the times when one is just oneself, and gets results that way you couldn't have got any other.
He paused and went on.
That's what happened to you last night, with the girl. She responded to the real you. That's why you feel badly about it.
I believe you're right, Tuppence.
I know, because I did the same thing myself with a German boy.
Tommy said, what do you think about him?
Tuppence said quickly,
if you ask me, I don't think he's got anything to do with it.
Grant thinks he has.
You're Mr. Grant.
Tuppence's mood changed. She chuckled.
Oh, I'd like to have seen his face when you told him about me.
Well, at any rate, he's made the amende honorable. You're definitely on the job.
Tuppence nodded, but she looked a trifle abstracted. She said,
do you remember after the last war, when we were hunting down Mr. Brown, do you remember what fun it was? How excited we were?
Tommy agreed, his face lighting up.
Rather.
Tommy, why isn't it the same now?
He considered the question, his quiet, ugly face grave. Then he said,
I suppose it's really a question of age.
Tuppence said sharply,
well, you don't think we're too old?
No, I'm sure we're not. It's only that for this time it won't be fun. It's the same in other ways. This is the second war we've been in, and we feel quite different about this one.
I know. We see the pity of it and the waste and the horror, all the things we were too young to think about before.
That's it. In the last war, I was scared every now and then. Had some pretty close shaves and went through hell once or twice. But they were good times, too.
Tuppence said,
I suppose Derek feels like that.
Better not think about him, old thing, Tommy advised.
You're right.
Tuppence set her teeth. We've got a job. We're going to do that job. Let's get on with it. Have we found what we're looking for in Mrs. Perenna?
Oh, we can at least say that she's strongly indicated.
There's no one else, is there, Tuppence, that you've got your eye on?
Tuppence considered.
No, there isn't. The first thing I did when I arrived, of course, was to size them all up and assess, as it were, possibilities. Some of them seem quite impossible.
Such as?
Well, Miss Minton, for instance, the complete British spinster, and Mrs. Sprott and her Betty, and the vacuous Mrs. Cayley.
Well, yes, but nitwittishness can be assumed.
Oh, quite, but the fussy spinster and the absorbed young mother are parts that would be fatally easy to overdo, and these people are quite natural.
Then, where Mrs. Sprott is concerned, there's the child.
I suppose, said Tommy, that even a secret agent might have a child.
Well, not with her on the job, said Tuppence. It's not the kind of thing you'd bring a child into, I'm quite sure about that, Tommy.
I know, I mean, you'd keep a child out of it.
I withdraw, said Tommy.
I'll give you Mrs. Sprott and Miss Minton, but I'm not sure about Mrs. Cayley.
No, she might be a possibility.
Because she really does overdo it. I mean, there can't be many women quite as idiotic as she seems.
I've often noticed that being a devoted wife saps the intellect, murmured Tommy.
And where have you noticed that? Demanded Tuppence.
Oh, not from you, Tuppence. Your devotion has never reached those lengths.
For a man, said Tuppence kindly, you don't really make an undue fuss when you're ill.
Tommy reverted to a survey of possibilities.
Cayley, said Tommy thoughtfully. There might be something fishy about Cayley.
Yes, there might.
Then there's Mrs. O'Rourke. What do you feel about her?
I don't quite know. She's disturbing. Rather fee-fo-fum, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yes, I think I know. But I rather fancy that's just the predatory note. She's that kind of woman.
Tuppen said slowly. She notices things. She was remembering the remark about knitting.
Then there's Bletchley, said Tommy.
I've hardly spoken to him. He's definitely your chicken.
I think he's just the ordinary pucker old school tie.
I think so.
That's just it, said Tuppence, answering a stress rather than actual words.
The worst of this sort of show is that you look at quite ordinary everyday people and twist them to suit your morbid requirements.
Well, I've tried a few experiments on Bletchley, said Tommy.
What sort of thing?
Got some experiments in mind myself. Well, just gentle, ordinary little traps about dates and places, all that sort of thing.
Could you condescend from the general to the particular?
Well, say we're talking of duck shooting. He mentions the Fayum. Good sport there, such and such a year, such and such a month. Some other time I mention Egypt in quite a different connection. Mummies, Tutankhamun, something like that. Has he seen that stuff? When was he there? And check up on the answers. Or P&O boats, I mention the names of one or two. Say so-and-so was a comfortable boat, he mentioned some trip or other. Later I check that, nothing important or anything that puts him on his guard, just a check up on accuracy.
And so far he hasn't slipped up in any way?
Not once. And that's a pretty good test, let me tell you, Tuppence.
Yes, but I suppose if he was N, he would have his story quite pat.
Oh, yes, the main outlines of it. But it's not so easy not to trip up on unimportant details. And then occasionally you remember too much, more, that is, than a bona fide person would do. An ordinary person doesn't usually remember offhand whether they took a certain shooting trip in 1926 or 1927. They have to think of it and search their memory.
But so far you haven't caught Bletchley out.
So far he's responded in a perfectly normal manner.
Result, negative.
Exactly.
Now, said Tuppence, I'll tell you some of my ideas. And she proceeded to do so.
On her way home, Mrs. Blenkinsop stopped at the post office. She bought stamps, and on her way out went into one of the public call boxes. There she rang up a certain number and asked for Mr. Faraday. This was the accepted method of communication with Mr. Grant. She came out smiling and walked slowly homewards, stopping on the way to purchase some knitting wool. It was a pleasant afternoon with a light breeze. Tuppence curbed the natural energy of her own brisk trot to that leisurely pace that accorded with her conception of the part of Mrs. Blenkinsop. Mrs. Blenkinsop had nothing on earth to do with herself except knit, not too well, and write letters to her boys. She was always writing letters to her boys. Sometimes she left them about half finished. Tuppence came slowly up the hill towards Sanssouci. Since it was not a through road, it ended at Smuggler's Rest, Commander Haydock's house, there was never much traffic. A few tradesmen's vans in the morning. Tuppence passed house after house, amusing herself by noting their names. Bella Vista, inaccurately named, since the merest glimpse of the sea was to be obtained, and the main view was the vast Victorian bulk of Edenholm on the other side of the road. Karachi was the next house. After that came Shirley Tower. Then Sea View, appropriate this time, Castle Clare, somewhat grandiloquent since it was a small house, Trelawney, a rival establishment to that of Mrs. Perenna, and finally the vast maroon bulk of Sanssouci. It was just as she came near to it that Tuppence became aware of a woman standing by the gate, peering inside. There was something tense and vigilant about the figure. Almost unconsciously, Tuppence softened the sound of her own footsteps, stepping cautiously upon her toes. It was not until she was close behind her that the woman heard her and turned with a start. She was a tall woman, poorly, even meanly dressed, but her face was unusual. She was not young, probably just under 40, but there was a contrast between her face and the way she was dressed. She was fair-haired, with wide cheekbones, and had been, indeed still was, beautiful. Just for a minute, Tuppence had a feeling that the woman's face was somehow familiar to her. But the feeling faded. It was not, she thought, a face easily forgotten. The woman was obviously startled,
and the flash of alarm that flitted across her face was not lost on Tuppence. Something odd here. Tuppence said, "Excuse me, are you looking for someone?" The woman spoke in a slow, foreign voice, pronouncing the words carefully as though she had learnt them by heart.
"This house is Sans Souci?"
"Yes, I live there. Did you want someone?" There was an infinitesimal pause. Then the woman said,
"You can tell me, please. There is a Mr. Rosenstein there, no?"
"Mr. Rosenstein?" Tuppence shook her head. "No, I'm afraid not. Perhaps he has been there and left. Shall I ask for you?" But the strange woman made a quick gesture of refusal. She said,
"No. No, I make mistake. Excuse, please."
Then quickly she turned and walked rapidly down the hill again. Tuppence stood staring after her. For some reason her suspicions were aroused. There was a contrast between the woman's manner and her words. Tuppence had an idea that Mr. Rosenstein was a fiction, that the woman had seized at the first name that came into her head. Tuppence hesitated a minute, then started down the hill after her. What she could only describe as a hunch made her want to follow the woman. Presently, however, she stopped. To follow would be to draw attention to herself in a rather marked manner. She had clearly been on the point of entering Sans Souci when she spoke to the woman. To reappear on her trail would be to arouse suspicion that Mrs. Blenkinsop was something other than appeared on the surface. That is to say, if this strange woman was indeed a member of the enemy plot. No, at all costs, Mrs. Blenkinsop must remain what she seemed. Tuppence turned and retraced her steps up the hill. She entered Sans Souci and paused in the hall. The house seemed deserted, as was usual early in the afternoon. Betty was having her nap. The elder members were either resting or had gone out. Then, as Tuppence stood in the dim hall thinking over her recent encounter, a faint sound came to her ears. It was a sound she knew quite well, the faint echo of a ting. The telephone at Sans Souci was in the hall. The sound that Tuppence had just heard was the sound made when the receiver of an extension is taken off or replaced. There was one extension in the house, in Mrs. Perenna's bedroom. Tommy might have hesitated. Tuppence did not hesitate for a minute. Very gently and carefully, she lifted off the receiver and put it to her ear. Someone was using the extension. It was a man's voice. "Everything going well," it said. "On the 4th, then, as arranged." A woman's voice replied, "Yes, carry on." There was a click as the receiver was replaced. Tuppence stood there, frowning. Was that Mrs. Perenna's voice? Difficult to say with only those three words to go upon. If there had been only a little more to the conversation. It might, of course, be quite an ordinary conversation. Certainly there was nothing in the words she had overheard to indicate otherwise. A shadow obscured the light from the door. Tuppence jumped and replaced the receiver as Mrs. Perenna spoke.
"Such a pleasant afternoon. Are you going out, Mrs. Blenkinsop? Or have you just come in?"
So it was not Mrs. Perenna who had been speaking from Mrs. Perenna's room. Tuppence murmured something about having had a pleasant walk and moved to the staircase. Mrs. Perenna moved along the hall after her. She seemed bigger than usual. Tuppence was conscious of her as a strong, athletic woman. She said,
"I must get my things off,"
and hurried up the stairs. As she turned the corner of the landing, she collided with Mrs. O'Rourke, whose vast bulk barred the top of the stairs.
"Dear, dear, now, Mrs. Blenkinsop, it's a great hurry you seem to be in."
She did not move aside, just stood there smiling down at Tuppence just below her. There was, as always, a frightening quality about Mrs. O'Rourke's smile. And suddenly, for no reason, Tuppence felt afraid. The big, smiling Irishwoman with her deep voice barring her way, and below Mrs. Perenna closing in at the foot of the stairs. Tuppence glanced over her shoulder. Was it her fancy that there was something definitely menacing in Mrs. Perenna's upturned face? Absurd, she told herself, absurd. In broad daylight? In a commonplace seaside boarding house? But the house was so very quiet. Not a sound. And she herself here on the stairs between the two of them. Surely there was something a little queer in Mrs. O'Rourke's smile. Some fixed, ferocious quality about it, Tuppence thought wildly. Like a cat with a mouse. And then suddenly the tension broke. A little figure darted along the top landing, uttering shrill squeals of mirth. Little Betty Sprott, in vest and knickers, darting past Mrs. O'Rourke, shouting happily, "Peek-boo!" as she flung herself on Tuppence. The atmosphere had changed. Mrs. O'Rourke, a big, genial figure, was crying out, "Ha-ha, the darling girl! It's a great girl she's getting!" Below, Mrs. Perenna had turned away to the door that led into the kitchen. Tuppence, Betty's hand clasped in hers, passed Mrs. O'Rourke and ran along the passage to where Mrs. Sprott was waiting to scold the truant. Tuppence went in with the child. She felt a queer sense of relief at the domestic atmosphere. The child's clothes lying about, the woolly toys, the painted crib, the sheep-like and somewhat unattractive face of Mr. Sprott in its frame on the dressing table. The burble of Mrs. Sprott's denunciation of laundry prices, and really, she thought Mrs. Perenna was a little unfair in refusing to sanction guests having their own electric irons. All so normal, so reassuring, so everyday. And yet, just now, on the stairs, "Nerves," said Tuppence to herself, "just nerves." But had it been nerves? Someone had been telephoning from Mrs. Perenna's room. Mrs. O'Rourke? Surely a very odd thing to do. It ensured, of course, that you would not be overheard by the household. It must have been, Tuppence thought, a very short conversation, the merest brief exchange of words. Everything going well, on the 4th, as arranged. It might mean nothing, or a good deal. The 4th. Was that a date? The 4th, say, of a month? Or it might mean the 4th seat, or the 4th lamppost, or the 4th breakwater. Impossible to know. It might just conceivably mean the 4th bridge. There had been an attempt to blow that up in the last war. Did it mean anything at all? It might easily have been the confirmation of some perfectly ordinary appointment. Mrs. Perenna might have told Mrs. O'Rourke she could use the telephone in her bedroom any time she wanted to do so. And the atmosphere on the stairs, that tense moment, might have been just her own overwrought nerves. The quiet house. The feeling that there was something sinister. Something evil. "Stick to facts, Mrs. Blenkinsop," said Tuppence sternly, "and get on with your job." Chapter 5. Commander Haydock turned out to be the most genial host. He welcomed Mr. Meadows and Major Bletchley with enthusiasm, and insisted on showing the former all over my little place. Smuggler's Rest had been originally a couple of Coast Guard's cottages standing on the cliff overlooking the sea. There was a small cove below, but the access to it was perilous, only to be attempted by adventurous boys. Then the cottages had been bought by a London businessman who had thrown them into one and attempted half-heartedly to make a garden. He had come down occasionally for short periods in summer. After that, the cottages had remained empty for some years, being let with the modicum of furniture to summer visitors. "Then some years ago," explained Haydock, "it was sold to a man called Hahn. He was a German, and if you ask me, he was neither more nor less than a spy." Tommy's ears quickened. "Oh, that's interesting," he said, putting down the glass from which he had been sipping sherry. "Damn thorough fellows they are," said Haydock, "getting ready even then for this show. At least, that's my opinion. Look at the situation of this place. Perfect for signalling out to sea. Cove below, where you could land a motorboat. Completely isolated owing to the contour of the cliff. Oh, yes. Don't tell me that fellow Hahn wasn't a German agent." Major Bletchley said, "Well, of course he was." "What happened to him?" asked Tommy. "Ah," said Haydock, "thereby hangs a tale. Hahn spent a lot of money on this place. He had a way cut down to the beach, for one thing. Concrete steps. Expensive business. Then he had the whole of the house done over. Bathrooms, every expensive gadget you can imagine. And who did he set to do all this? Not a local man. No, a firm from London, so it was said. But a lot of the men who came down were foreigners. Some of them didn't speak a word of English. Don't you agree with me that that sounds extremely fishy?" "A little odd, certainly," agreed Tommy. "I was in the neighbourhood myself at the time.
living in a bungalow, and I got interested in what this fellow was up to. I used to hang about to watch the workmen. Now, I'll tell you this. They didn't like it. They didn't like it at all. Once or twice, they were quite threatening about it. Why should they be if everyone was all square and above board? Letchley nodded agreement.
You ought to have gone to the authorities, he said.
Just what I did do, my dear fellow. Made a positive nuisance of myself pestering the police. He poured himself out another drink. And what did I get for my pains? Polite inattention. Blind and deaf. That's what we were in this country. Another war with Germany was out of the question. There was peace in Europe, our relations with Germany were excellent. Natural sympathy between us nowadays. I was regarded as an old fossil, a war maniac, a die-hard old sailor. What was the good of pointing out to people that the Germans were building the finest air force in Europe, and not just to fly around and have picnics? Major Bletchley said explosively,
Nobody believed it, damn fools. Peace in our time. Appeasement. All a lot of blah.
Haydock said, his face redder than usual with suppressed anger,
A warmonger. That's what they called me. The sort of chap, they said, who was an obstacle to peace. Peace! I knew what our Hun friends were at, and mind this, they prepare things a long time beforehand. I was convinced that Mr. Hahn was up to no good. I didn't like his foreign workmen. I didn't like the way he was spending money on this place. I kept on badgering away at people.
Stout fellow, said Bletchley appreciatively.
And finally, said the commander, I began to make an impression. We had a new chief constable down here, retired soldier, and he had the sense to listen to me. His fellows began to nose around. Sure enough, Hahn decamped. Just slipped out and disappeared one fine night. The police went over this place with a search warrant. In a safe which had been built in the dining room, they found a wireless transmitter and some pretty damaging documents. Also a big store place under the garage for petrol. Great tanks! I can tell you, I was cock-a-hoop over that. Fellows at the club used to rag me about my German spy complex. They dried up after that. Trouble with us in this country is that we're so absurdly unsuspicious.
It's a crime. Fools, that's what we are, fools. Why didn't we intern all these refugees?
Major Bletchley was well away. End of the story was I bought the place when it came into the market, continued the commander, not to be sidetracked from his pet story.
Come and have a look round, Meadows.
Oh, thanks, I'd like to. Commander Haydock was as full of zest as a boy as he did the honours of the establishment. He threw open the big safe in the dining room to show where the secret wireless had been found. Tommy was taken out to the garage and was shown where the big petrol tanks had lain concealed. And finally, after a superficial glance at the two excellent bathrooms, the special lighting and the various kitchen gadgets, he was taken down the steep concrete path to the little cove beneath, whilst Commander Haydock told him all over again how extremely useful the whole layout would be to an enemy in wartime. He was taken into the cave which gave the place its name, and Haydock pointed out enthusiastically how it could have been used. Major Bletchley did not accompany the two men on their tour, but remained peacefully sipping his drink on the terrace. Tommy gathered that the commander's spy hunt, with its successful issue, was that good gentleman's principal topic of conversation, and that his friends had heard it many times before. In fact, Major Bletchley said as much when they were walking down to Sanssouci a little later.
Good fellow, Haydock, he said, but he's not content to let a good thing alone. We've heard all about that business again and again until we're sick of it. He's as proud of the whole bag of tricks up there as a cat of its kittens.
The simile was not too far-fetched, and Tommy assented with a smile. The conversation then turning to Major Bletchley's own successful unmasking of a dishonest bearer in 1923, Tommy's attention was free to pursue its own inward line of thought, punctuated by sympathetic, not really's, or, you don't say so. And what an extraordinary business, which was all Major Bletchley needed in the way of encouragement. More than ever now, Tommy felt that when the dying Farquhar had mentioned Sanssouci, he had been on the right track. Here, in this out-of-the-world spot, preparations had been made a long time beforehand. The arrival of the German, Hahn, and his extensive installation showed clearly enough that this particular part of the coast had been selected for a rallying point. A focus of enemy activity. That particular game had been defeated by the unexpected activity of the suspicious Commander Haydock. Round one had gone to Britain. But supposing that Smuggler's Rest had been only the first outpost of a complicated scheme of attack. Smuggler's Rest, that is to say, had represented sea communications. Its beach, inaccessible save for the path down from above, would lend itself admirably to the plan. But it was only a part of the whole. Defeated on that part of the plan by Haydock, what had been the enemy's response? Might not he have fallen back upon the next best thing? That is to say, Sans Souci. The exposure of Hahn had come about 4 years ago. Tommy had an idea, from what Sheila Perenna had said, that it was very soon after that that Mrs. Perenna had returned to England and bought Sans Souci. The next move in the game? It would seem, therefore, that Leehampton was definitely an enemy centre, that there were already installations and affiliations in the neighbourhood. His spirits rose. The depression, engendered by the harmless and futile atmosphere of Sans Souci, disappeared. Innocent as it seemed, that innocence was no more than skin deep. Behind that innocuous mask, things were going on. And the focus of it all, as far as Tommy could judge, was Mrs. Perenna. The first thing to do was to know more about Mrs. Perenna, to penetrate behind her apparently simple routine of running her boarding establishment, her correspondence, her acquaintances, her social or war-working activities. Somewhere in all these must lie the essence of her real activities. If Mrs. Perenna was the renowned woman agent M, then it was she who controlled the whole of the fifth column activities in this country. Her identity would be known to few, only to those at the top. But she must have communications with her chiefs of staff, and it was those communications that he and Tuppence had got to tap. At the right moment, as Tommy saw well enough, Smuggler's Rest could be seized and held by a few stalwarts operating from Sans Souci. That moment was not yet, but it might be very near. Once the German army was established in control of the Channel ports in France and Belgium, they could concentrate on the invasion and subjugation of Britain. And things were certainly going very badly in France at the moment. Britain's navy was all-powerful on the sea, so the attack must come by air and by internal treachery, and if the threads of internal treachery were in Mrs. Perenna's keeping, there was no time to lose. Major Bletchley's words chimed in with his thoughts.
I saw, you know, that there was no time to lose. I got hold of Abdul, my syce. Good fellow, Abdul.
The story droned on. Tommy was thinking, why Leehampton? Any reason?
It's out of the mainstream.
Bit of a backwater. Conservative. Old-fashioned. All those points make it desirable. Is there anything else? There was a stretch of flat agricultural country behind it running inland, a lot of pasture, suitable, therefore, for the landing of troop-carrying airplanes or of parachute troops. But that was true of many other places. There was also a big chemical works where, it might be noted, Carl von Deinem was employed. Carl von Deinem. How did he fit in? Only too well. He was not, as Grant had pointed out, the real head, a cog only in the machine, liable to suspicion and internment at any moment, but in the meantime he might have accomplished what had been his task. He had mentioned to Tuppence that he was working on decontamination problems and on the immunizing of certain gases. There were probabilities there. Probabilities unpleasant to contemplate. Carl, Tommy decided, a little reluctantly, was in it. A pity, because he rather liked the fellow. Well, he was working for his country, taking his life in his hands. Tommy had respect for such an adversary. Down him, by all means. A firing party was the end. But you knew that when you took on your job. It was the people who betrayed their own land from within that really roused a slow, vindictive passion in him. By God, he'd get them.
And that's how I got them, the Major wound up his story triumphantly. Pretty smart bit of work, eh?
Unblushingly, Tommy said, most ingenious thing I've heard in my life, Major. Mrs. Blenkinsop was reading a letter on thin foreign paper stamped outside with the censor's mark. Incidentally, the direct result of her conversation with Mr. Faraday. Dear Raymond, she murmured, I was so happy about him out in Egypt. And now it seems there is a big change round, all very secret, of course, and he can't say anything. Just that there really is a marvellous plan, and that I'm to be ready for some big surprise soon. I'm glad to know where he's being sent, but I really don't see why... Letchley grunted.
Surely he's not allowed to tell you that.
Tuppence gave a deprecating laugh and looked round the breakfast table as she folded up her precious letter.
Oh, we have our methods, she said archly.
Dear Raymond knows that if I only know where he is or where he's going, I don't worry quite so much. It's quite a simple way, too. Just a certain word, you know, and after it, the initial letters of the next words spell out the place. Of course, it makes rather a funny sentence sometimes, but Raymond is really most ingenious. I'm sure nobody would notice.
Little murmurs arose round the table. The moment was well chosen. Everybody happened to be at the breakfast table together for once. Letchley, his face rather red, said,
You'll excuse me, Mrs. Blenkinsop, but that's a damn foolish thing to do. Movements of troops and air squadrons are just what the Germans want to know.
Oh, but I never tell anyone, cried Tuppence. I'm very, very careful.
All the same, it's an unwise thing to do, and your boy will get into trouble over it some day.
Oh, I do hope not. I'm his mother, you see. A mother ought to know.
Indeed, I think you're right, boomed out Mrs. O'Rourke. Wild horses wouldn't drag the information from you, we know that.
Letters can be read, said Bletchley.
I'm very careful never to leave letters lying about, said Tuppence, with an air of outraged dignity. I always keep them locked up.
Bletchley shook his head doubtfully. It was a grey morning, with the wind blowing coldly from the sea. Tuppence was alone at the far end of the beach. She took from her bag two letters that she had just called for at a small newsagent's in the town. They had taken some time in coming since they had been readdressed there, the second time to a Mrs. Spender. Tuppence liked crossing her tracks. Her children believed her to be in Cornwall with an old aunt. She opened the first letter. Dearest Mother, lots of funny things I could tell you, only I mustn't. We're putting up a good show, I think. 5 German planes before breakfast is today's market quotation. Bit of a mess at the moment and all that, but we'll get there all right in the end. It's the way they machine-gun the poor civilian devils on the roads that gets me. Makes us all see red. Gus and Trundles want to be remembered to you. They're still going strong. Don't worry about me, I'm all right. Wouldn't have missed this show for the world. Love to old Carrot Top. Have the W.O. given him a job yet? Yours ever, Derek.
Tuppence's eyes were very bright and shining as she read and re-read this. Then she opened the other letter. Dearest Mum, how's old Aunt Gracie? Going strong? I think you're wonderful to stick it, I couldn't.
No news. My job is very interesting, but so hush-hush I can't tell you about it. But I really do feel I'm doing something worthwhile.
Don't fret about not getting any war work to do. It's so silly, all these elderly women rushing about wanting to do things. They only really want people who are young and efficient. I wonder how Carrots is getting on at his job up in Scotland. Just filling up forms, I suppose. Still, he'll be happy to feel he's doing something. Lots of love, Deborah.
Tuppence smiled. She folded the letters, smoothed them lovingly, and then, under the shelter of a breakwater, she struck a match and set them on fire. She waited until they were reduced to ashes. Taking out her fountain pen and a small writing pad, she wrote rapidly, Langhern, Cornwall. Dearest Deb, it seems so remote from the war here that I can hardly believe there's a war going on. Very glad to get your letter and know that your work is interesting. Aunt Gracie has grown much more feeble and very hazy in her mind. I think she's glad to have me here. She talks a good deal about the old days and sometimes, I think, confuses me with my own mother. They're growing more vegetables than usual. I've turned the rose garden into potatoes. I help old Sykes a bit. It makes me feel I'm doing something in the war. Your father seems a bit disgruntled, but I think, as you say, he too is glad to be doing something. Love from your Tuppenny mother. She took a fresh sheet. Darling Derek, a great comfort to get your letter. Send field postcards often if you haven't time to write. I've come down to be with Aunt Gracie a bit. She's very feeble. She will talk of you as though you were 7 and gave me 10 shillings yesterday to send you as a tip. I'm still on the shelf, and nobody wants my invaluable services. Extraordinary. Your father, as I told you, has got a job in the Ministry of Requirements. He's up north somewhere. Better than nothing.
but not what he wanted, poor old Carrot Top. Still, I suppose we've got to be humble and take a back seat and leave the war to you young idiots. I won't say take care of yourself, because I gather the whole point is that you should do just the opposite. But don't go and be stupid. Lots of love, Tuppence. She put the letters into envelopes, addressed and stamped them, and posted them on her way back to Sanssouci. As she reached the bottom of the cliff, her attention was caught by two figures, standing talking a little way up. Tuppence stopped dead. It was the same woman she had seen yesterday, and talking to her was Carl von Deinem. Regretfully, Tuppence noted the fact that there was no cover. She could not get near them unseen and overhear what was being said. Moreover, at that moment, the young German turned his head and saw her. Rather abruptly, the two figures parted. The woman came rapidly down the hill, crossing the road and passing Tuppence on the other side. Carl von Deinem waited until Tuppence came up to him. Then, gravely and politely, he wished her good morning. Tuppence said immediately, "What a very odd-looking woman that was to whom you were talking, Mr. Deinem."
Yes, it is a Central European type. She is a Pole.
Oh, really? A friend of yours? Tuppence's tone was a very good copy of the inquisitive voice of Aunt Gracie in her younger days.
"Not at all," said Carl stiffly. "I never saw the woman before."
"Oh, really? I thought..." Tuppence paused artistically.
"She asked me only for a direction. I speak German to her because she does not understand much English."
"I see.
And she was asking the way somewhere?"
"She asked me if I knew a Mrs. Gottlieb near here. I do not, and she says she has perhaps got the name of the house wrong." "I see," said Tuppence thoughtfully. "Mr. Rosenstein. Mrs. Gottlieb." She stole a swift glance at Carl von Deinem. He was walking beside her with a set, stiff face. Tuppence felt a definite suspicion of this strange woman, and she felt almost convinced that when she had first caught sight of them, the woman and Carl had already been talking some time together.
Carl von Deinem? Carl and Sheila that morning. You must be careful.
Tuppence thought, I hope these young things aren't in it. Soft, she told herself, middle-aged and soft. That's what she was. The Nazi creed was a youth creed. Nazi agents would in all probability be young. Carl and Sheila. Tommy said Sheila wasn't in it. Yes, but Tommy was a man, and Sheila was beautiful, with a queer, breathtaking beauty. Carl and Sheila. And behind them, that enigmatic figure, Mrs. Perenna. Mrs. Perenna, sometimes the voluble, commonplace guest-house hostess, sometimes, for fleeting minutes, a tragic, violent personality. Tuppence went slowly upstairs to her bedroom. That evening, when she went to bed, she pulled out the long drawer of her bureau. At one side of it was a small japanned box with a flimsy, cheap lock. Tuppence slipped on gloves, unlocked the box, and opened it. A pile of letters lay inside. On the top was the one received that morning from Raymond. Tuppence unfolded it with due precautions. Then her lips set grimly. There had been an eyelash in the fold of the paper this morning. The eyelash was not there now. She went to the washstand. There was a little bottle labelled innocently grey powder, with a dose. Adroitly, Tuppence dusted a little of the powder onto the letter and onto the surface of the glossy japanned enamel of the box. There were no fingerprints on either of them. Again, Tuppence nodded her head with a certain grim satisfaction. Well, there should have been fingerprints. Her own. A servant might have read the letters out of curiosity, though it seemed unlikely, certainly unlikely that she should have gone to the trouble of finding a key to fit the box. But a servant would not think of wiping off fingerprints. Mrs. Perenna? Sheila? Somebody else? Somebody, at least, who was interested in the movements of British armed forces. Tuppence's plan of campaign had been simple in its outlines. First, a general sizing up of probabilities and possibilities. Second, an experiment to determine whether there was or was not an inmate of Sanssouci who was interested in troop movements and anxious to conceal the fact. Third, who that person was. It was concerning that third operation that Tuppence pondered as she lay in bed the following morning. Her train of thought was slightly hampered by Betty Sprott, who had pranced in at an early hour, preceding, indeed, the cup of somewhat tepid, inky liquid known as morning tea. Betty was both active and voluble. She had taken a great fancy to Tuppence. She climbed up on the bed and thrust an extremely tattered picture book under Tuppence's nose, commanding with brevity, "Weed!" Tuppence read obediently, "Goosey, goosey, gander, whither will you wander? Upstairs, downstairs, in my lady's chamber." Betty rolled with mirth, repeating in an ecstasy, "Upstairs, upstairs, upstairs," and then with a sudden climax, "Down," and proceeded to roll off the bed with a thump. This proceeding was repeated several times until it palled. Then Betty crawled about the floor, playing with Tuppence's shoes and muttering to herself busily in her own particular idiom. Released to fly back to its own perplexities, Tuppence's mind forgot the child. The words of the nursery rhyme seemed to mock at her. "Goosey, goosey, gander, whither shall ye wander?" Whither indeed? Goosey, that was her. Gander was Tommy. It was, at any rate, what they appeared to be. Tuppence had the heartiest contempt for Mrs. Blenkinsop. Mr. Meadows, the thought was a little better, stolid, British, unimaginative, quite incredibly stupid. Both of them, she hoped, fitting nicely into the background of Sanssouci, both such possible people to be there. All the same, one must not relax. A slip was so easy. She had made one the other day. Nothing that mattered, but just a sufficient indication to warn her to be careful. Such an easy approach to intimacy and good relations, an indifferent knitter asking for guidance. But she had forgotten that one evening, her fingers had slipped into their own practiced efficiency, the needles clicking busily with the even note of the experienced knitter. Mrs. O'Rourke had noticed it. Since then she had carefully struck a medium course, not so clumsy as she had been at first, but not so rapid as she could be. Her next step, Tuppence thought, could be managed easily enough, that is to say, with the connivance of Tommy. She saw exactly how to do it. Lying there, planning, time slipped by. Mrs. Sprott came in, breathless, to seek for Betty.
"Oh, here she is. I couldn't think where she'd got to. Oh, Betty, you naughty girl. Oh, dear, Mrs. Blenkinsop, I'm so sorry."
Tuppence sat up in bed. Betty, with an angelic face, was contemplating her handiwork. She had removed all the laces from Tuppence's shoes and had immersed them in a tooth glass of water. She was prodding them now with a gleeful finger. Tuppence laughed and cut short Mrs. Sprott's apologies.
"Oh, how frightfully funny. Don't worry, Mrs. Sprott. They'll recover all right. It's my fault. I should have noticed what she was doing. She was rather quiet." "I know," Mrs. Sprott sighed. "Whenever they're quiet, it's a bad sign. I'll get you some more laces this morning, Mrs. Blenkinsop." "Oh, don't bother," said Tuppence. "They'll dry none the worse."
Mrs. Sprott bore Betty away, and Tuppence got up to put her plan into execution.